This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we are here to talk about in this episode include...
Seizing the Mission.
Liminal versus Reality Horror.
The Word Seems.
And historical figures who ID'd Ken.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of, it's once more, it's not the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton. He will be coming alive in, depending on how you count it, 300 or 900 years, because we are once more on the battlements of Elsinore in a windswept edition of the Gaming Hut that occurs behind, or I guess in front of, it, around, Hamlet's GM screen, Robin's newest book on story beats in your very own game. Not just those run by a melancholy Dane, those run by a melancholy GM of any nationality. Robin, we've gotten through the mission, we've gotten through the intro, now we're doing the handoff, the part where you turn to the players and you say, so what do you want to do, right?
Yes. So the guy with the hat has told you the thing, and now it's what to do. So the part of this is we're now finally, hopefully not so finally in your actual game where you got through the other stuff relatively quickly,
right,
are entering the part where things become interactive and the story beats, the ups and downs of engagement that occur are not just about you presenting material to the players and them reacting to you, but now the players are starting to react to one another. That means that the control over the oscillation between hope and fear, which is going to be kind of low key at the beginning because they're not in danger yet. They're deciding how to get into danger. But that control is now a group matter. And your role as GM is to just sort of keep a little eye on it and eventually just subliminally keep an eye on it and make sure that things run smoothly. So the existence of a problem, of a mission, is a question beat. And the implicit question is, what are we going to do about this? So if the problem is that the centipede folk hold up in an old fortress or harrying farmers, the solution to that problem probably that the players are going to say was like, well, let's go to the fortress. Or if the ship receives a distress call from a stellar anomaly, it's like, let's plot a course for the anomaly. Or Dr. Menace has robbed the jewelry store, you go to the jewelry store. So that is the simplest possible version of that. And the player beat where they say what they're going to do is generally an upbeat because a plan of action, looking forward to a thing that can begin the problem solving, is usually positive. It's an upbeat. We have a thing to do. Yay. We know where to go. Yay. We know what to do. The thing about all of those examples is that there's a single thing that makes sense for them to do. And there's a trade-off involved in that, is that you get them there really quickly. They know what to do. They're all on the same page at the beginning. And that may well be the best choice. The other possibility to look at, though, is giving them a range of possible first things to do.
And a lot of times the choice of a range is not just going to depend on, you know, how much time you have or the rhythm at the table. It's kind of going to depend on the genre, because in a traditional Trail of Cthulhu or investigative horror adventure, you don't just say the house is haunted by a mean ghost and everyone just sort of goes to the haunted house. I mean, you do say that a lot, but often you say there's a mean ghost predating in this town, and you go and you do investigation and you look around, and eventually you narrow it down. Ah, it's the house of the mean ghost, or it's the old mill of the Shoggoth, or whatever it is. And so likewise, in many Supers games, you're like, well, there's a robbery at the jewelry store. Let's go punch him. But sometimes you're in a more Batman type Supers game where there's a series of robberies that you've already missed somehow. You're maybe on a mission in space with Elongated Man or whatever, but now you've come back and you have to do some solving. And so I guess the question is the genre one that expects immediate rush to action, like most, I think, F20, or is it one that sort of can open up? And if you still want that question beat, or you want that choice of beats rather, in a traditional rush to action genre, how do you get it? And I feel like you're just about to tell me how you get it.
Right. And even within a particular game, there can be dials that suggest whether you want to go for the single fast choice that gets things moving, or the more than one choice that gives the players a sense of agency. So for example, in Knights Black Agents, if you're running a sort of action-oriented game that emphasizes the thrills, you can start with the problem is there's guys shooting at you. Whereas if you're doing the Dust version, it's like, you know, you've received a dossier with a troubling note in it, and there's an indecipherable scrawl, and both of those have different responses. And so, yes, absolutely, the genre and the expectations of your players will partly determine this. So for examples where there is more than one possibility, you mentioned the haunted house. So, you know, you've inherited a haunted house scenario can be you research the house or you go to the house. If the people in your F20 game come to you and they complain that there are groans coming from the cemetery that they live next to, it's like, well, we can go and interview people, find out what the deal is, or we can just go straight there. Or, you know, the businessman seeks help with a doppelganger robbery, and you can go to the bank where the doppelgangers withdrew the victim's cash, or you can talk to the victim's neighbors and see, you know, has there been doppelganger activity? Have you seen two versions of your neighbor? And so all of those throw more agency to the players at the expense of pacing. So for example, in the cemetery neighbors example, where the head of the neighborhood watch is telling you about this problem, you know, one of the players can go restate the options, and then you can have possibly a split within the group. It's like some people are like, well, let's go right there. And the other people are like, well, let's talk to people. And so in there, that can be kind of an ambiguous beat, because there's a question within the party. The person who feels that their character always wants more information can get in a drama beat and feel that they've expressed something about their character. So that's an upbeat for them. We can have another player sort of shoot that down because they want to get to it. That's a downbeat. And so this relatively simple matter has now acquired a rich series of up and down beats, but delays getting there. And you can't always predict whether the choice discussion is going to be the fun meat of why people play, getting together, making plans, doing stuff, or will be a source of, you know, people getting bogged down or in conflict right away. And so that's why you have to sort of pay attention at the table and decide whether to guide things. So like a lot of things covered in Hamlet's GM screen, often now that the players are in charge, the question that you have is, do I let this play out, or do I kind of nudge it along in either increasing the tension or decreasing the tension, depending on what the problem is?
And I guess that's as good a time as any to sort of get to the sort of the difference in feel at the table when it is just a player upbeat, downbeat, I got my way, I didn't get my way, versus a role-playing character upbeat, downbeat, we had a great argument, Spock and McCoy. Sure, it didn't get us any closer to the anomaly, but we got some good role playing and everyone was like, this is what we signed up for when we were playing Classic Trek. This is actual story meat, even though the anomaly is still just anomalating around, not helping anybody. And so I guess the question is, first of all, is there a meaningful difference if you're still getting up and down beats, whether it comes from player feelings or character feelings? And second of all, is there a preferential one in terms of guiding the whole story? My sort of instinct is to say you want to guide as much of the beats into character because it's role playing, right? But on the other hand, it's more natural to do up and down beats, you know, out of character, because often people don't want to, you know, think, okay, how would my paladin put this argument when I personally think it's stupid to go right to the cemetery when we don't know anything, right?
Right. And in general, I think most players are either oriented toward one or the other, that they, any player sort of has an intrinsic extent to which they speak in or out of character or think in and out of character. And when those two things clash, things can kind of get wobbly and require gentle intervention from the GM. So if I'm being a stick in the mud because I'm playing McCoy and suggesting that Spock's logical course of action is a little too logical, that can be annoying for the Spock character if they're mostly thinking in terms of being a player. One way to sort of encourage that over time is, first of all, to make interactions with Game Master characters more interesting, and to switch from plugging Hamlet's GM screen to plugging Hillfolk, playing a little bit of drama system can help players who are used to just thinking of their characters as, you know, play pieces, and get them to sort of open into the character part of it so that they can distinguish more whether they are making an objection as Jim Bob or are making an objection as McCoy. And that can smooth things out a little, because of course, like any expectations mismatches are a big problem at any phase of a role-playing game. And so helping to make that work is better. If you can get everybody playing as their characters so that the objection is a character point that says something about theme rather than just sort of a conflictive way of thinking between players, I think that is stronger and gives you something that's in the story that you can work with, so that when you pay off the scene where, oh wait, McCoy's objection turned out to be somewhat valid, even though it was overruled, that is the Trekkiest thing you can possibly get to, right?
Right. And that is sort of your job as the GM, is to sort of pick up everything the players lay down, even if they think they're just role-playing. How dare I say that? Even if they think they're doing drama instead of plot, again, two things that are the same thing, but you know what I mean? They're doing character moments instead of advancing the investigation.
Drama or procedural, as we would say in Hamlet's GM screen.
You might say, if only we had some sort of book with a lexicon.
With diagrams that map.
Diagrams, even. Yeah, anyway, that'd be a good book. We should talk about that.
We should talk about that book at length.
What I'm trying to suggest is that your job as the GM is to always be drawing things, even if they seemed like they were go-nowhere downbeats or go-nowhere sidebeats, back into the main story and have them pay off, because a payoff is one of the most reliable upbeats imaginable at the table, when the players all go, oh, right, or oh, that's cool, or hey, that rhymed, or now I get it. And that's always a really good upbeat, is the players recognizing that a thing is paying off in some way, whether it's a pipe you laid as the GM or something even better that they laid down in their own creativity.
And if you're looking for a compromise, if you have a group that will, some of them will respond to A and some to B, the way to do that is to start with a very simple choice. And then once they make that choice, get them as quickly as possible to choice two.
Right.
And that's as close to cake and eating it too as you can get, without getting icing all over your GM screen.
And that may give you the sense that, all right, they've had their fun of their argument. Now they would like to stab some centipede people and get into the procedural beats a little more and move through the story.
Right. And speaking of moving through things, it's time for us to move through this exciting commercial message into another hut and or segment.
In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Maryshire, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Yeah, can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Maryshire Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked. Remember, you're supposed to be solving a case. Gather some more clues. Question more eccentric locals.
Possibly chase a swan or something.
And slowly piece together the truth.
Now on Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Maryshire into your favorite search engine to find the campaign page. It's time once more for that most terrifying of huts. The hut that is practically in 3D because it is the Horror Hut. And this time around, people have had enough time now to see back rooms for us to sort of conceptually spoil it, I guess, at any rate. Not that there's a lot to spoil, really, because it is liminal horror, horror that occurs on the boundary between things. The director, Kane Parsons, is a very articulate dude who's talked a lot about his thinking behind the film, and therefore, suddenly a new horror subgenre that isn't new at all, because we're going to talk about its history, is on everybody's tongue. That's what's new, that where people are talking about it, and that is liminal horror. And people around here know that I'm known for writing some reality horror, particularly in the Yellow King role-playing game, and sometimes reality horror and liminal horror kind of seem like the same thing, but we're going to look at this and find out that they're neighbors, they're pals, these two subgenres, but they're kind of distinct. And in fact,
perhaps they have a spooky boundary between them.
A spooky boundary between them. And Parsons himself has been very explicit about the fact that in his mythology of backrooms, the important thing about the weird labyrinth of anodyne office space that the protagonists find themselves entering in and kind of trapped in isn't shifting on them. It appears to be infinite in its invasion of some sort of sub-reality, but you don't turn around ever and see that something different is behind you. So he's very specific that it is liminal horror, the horror of entering a weird new space, not the fact that the space is constantly changing on you or is subjective to it. There's the characters have a psychic relationship to that space and it has a psychic relationship to them, but it's not changing around on them. So, Ken, what founding works of horror come to your mind when you think of horror about boundaries between usually our realm and some sort of horrible other realm or reality?
Well, I mean, the classic example, and in the sense that it is literally in the name, is William Hope Hodgson's novel House on the Borderland, which is about a house that exists, guess what, Robin, on the borderland between our world and a world mostly of satanic pigmen. Not good. It's in West Ireland, so if you're curious, stay away from that area. And then he would go back and forth with what we might consider to be liminal horror, in which people go out often onto the sea, and then they have sailed into a strange and mysterious land. So I guess the first liminal horror in some senses would be the Odyssey, right? Where if you open up Aeolus's windbag and get blown all over, don't come whining to me if you're eaten by a Laestrygonian. That's sort of the motto there. But Boats of the Glencairig is the other great William Hope Hodgson liminal horror novel, despite it being in a weird 18th century dialect that does not help anybody. But there we are. It was a different time. Again, the question of crossing a boundary is implicit in all of Lovecraft. Lovecraft was a big fan of boundaries around a lot of stuff that we maybe don't think we need boundaries around now. But whenever they're crossed, bad stuff happens. So in a way, all of his work is liminal horror, going back to Reanimator, which is maybe the, again, one of the oldest liminal horrors, is crossing between the living and the dead. And it's not so much that that's so bad, but it's the recrossing. That's where people start getting hinky. But in many, many ways, the notion, as Parsons puts it, that you cross into the world and there is a reality there that is constant, is part of the scariness of Lovecraft. If Cthulhu is only sometimes there, that would be bad. It's the fact that Cthulhu is always there and you're just too ignorant to recognize it that is the real horror in Call of Cthulhu. And again, I think he most explicitly talks about what the geometry of the boundary looks like in Dreams in the Witch House, but Shadow over Innsmouth is basically him doing liminal horror over and over and over and over, because it's the boundary between the sea and the land. It's the boundary between fish and people. It's the boundary between monstrous and human. It's over and over and over. It's just a series of boundaries, all being contravened in dire fashion. So that's sort of the old school stuff.
Right. And Brown Jenkin is a boundary crosser. He's got the head of a person and the body of a rat. So he's on the boundary between different creatures. Liminal creatures in the mythos are the Hounds of Tyndalos, who are essentially literally weird angles or portals. And you have a couple of other newer literary examples.
Yeah. Stephen King wrote a long, like a novella called N, which is about sort of that sensation that, and this, I think, really gets to what liminal horror does, you know, in its modern literary or cinematic incarnation, is it plays with the sense of unease about knowing what's on that other side of the boundary. Maybe you never quite know. Maybe you never understand it, you know, as in Backrooms or even as in Dreams of the Witch House. But it's the sense that you keep crossing that boundary, maybe without meaning to, or that the boundary is sort of creeping towards you. And that is what N does really, really well in Stephen King. The fundamental thing is we begin with, there's a number of standing stones. We don't know how many there are because we can't count them. And then from that, a Stephen King novella emerges. And the funny thing is that he's homaging a story by Mackin called N, which is liminal wonder, which is, oh, there's a paradise on the other side of the boundary, but we're too gross. We can't go to the paradise. Every now and again, we accidentally notice a paradise, and then we feel bad. And that's sort of a wild notion to do things with liminals that are not just in the horror hut, but Mackin is more normally in the horror hut, but he's not as immediately concerned with boundaries as his heir Lovecraft is. And then Vandermeer's Annihilation is another classic liminal horror where there's a whole zone. It's a bad zone. Can't go to the zone. Inside the zone, bad stuff. And the boundary is sort of growing a little bit into the southeast, and that's not good. And so that is classic go into the bad place and see what's what novel by him. And then got it. I want to say more Lovecraftian gloss when Alex Garland made the movie of Annihilation. And so you can see how two different artists would approach that same basic liminal concept. I mean, literally the same basic liminal concept.
Right. And he draws on Carpenter's The Thing as well. And so you've got a boundary, a biological boundary being crossed. Right. Speaking of boundaries, in both senses of the word, the Hellraiser series, Clive Barker is the creatures, the Cenobites are literally unlocked from another dimension and coming here to infect this dimension, but also they are crossing psychosexual boundaries as well, which lends them that extra frisson of 90s terror. There's a danger, of course, of you can sort of metaphorize everything in horror as being a boundary, right? Entering Dracula's castle, we've entered the boundary into danger.
Cross the boundary into Transylvania, that's bad.
Yeah, if every haunted house is a boundary between the living and the dead, then the term is no longer meaningful. Poltergeist is an interesting example, whereas the Poltergeist 1, there's a sense that there's an other realm. Of course, the kid gets sucked into the TV, but in Poltergeist 2, it's very much a liminal horror because they go to that other terrible realm.
So the thing with Poltergeist, the fun thing about Poltergeist is that they sort of have the explanation in their heads for what's going on, that they're built on the Indian burial ground. And I think that moves us towards, if it is important to people to boundarize liminal horror, which seems like an odd thing, an odd quest, but you do you, that you can differentiate between houses that contain evil or were built from evil, like Haunting of Hill House, and the houses that are just geographically next door to evil zip code. And that would be, you know, literally the house on the borderland, or it would be, to some extent, you could take Danielewski's The House of Leaves, although I would argue that that is not so much liminal horror as our next example of horror, which is to say reality horror, Robin.
Right. So Robert W. Chambers is, of course, the signpost for this. Three of his Yellow King stories are to different extents about a shift in reality, either possibly just subjectively, but possibly a subjective change in reality that is becoming objective. And so there's an ambiguity there as to reality being changed. And then many other people have seized on that and made it more explicitly the fact that the horror is not that you've crossed a border zone, but just the reality under your feet is changing on you, that you've entered a realm of subjectivity. And so if you're entering the Yellow King's version of the back rooms, indeed, when you turn around, you're not going to have the same weird room behind you. You've got a different weird room behind you. You've already mentioned House of Leaves. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that and another literary example.
Yeah, I think House of Leaves is an interesting case because in that novel, Danielewski's novel, the house begins as just, you know, it's a haunted house. It's a bad place. You go into it, you're crossing a boundary. That sort of makes sense. But then the character and implicitly you, the reader, the house is following you back out. And that is what I think makes it a little more reality horror. It's not that they're following you back out to do you ill like the Cenobites. It's following you back out to change and alter your reality. And in a sort of Borgesian sense, and of course, if you're talking about foundational works of reality horror, Tlon, Ukbar, Orbis Tertius by Borges is the, you know, the other signpost besides Repair of Reputations or The Yellow Sun. So that is, you know, one of the stories about, oh, the other reality is colonizing ours and there's nothing we can do about it. Again, a lot of those themes go back to things like War of the Worlds, where Wells is very, very concerned about colonialization. He thinks it is bad, especially when done to Britain by Martians. But that is also a kind of a reality horror. People have come in and they've changed your language. They've changed your religion. They've changed all your ways of life. So in a way, the cargo cults of the Pacific are a response to reality horror in a way of realistic reality horror. And a lot of things, as we have talked about endlessly, that begin as real social concerns become cool horror movies. And there's a lot of those. I noted Houseu by Nobuhiko Obayashi, which is another haunted house movie, but it is also very much a, oh no, nothing makes any sense. Things are changing all the time. You cannot follow it logically. It's best case child brain, worst case completely random horror and weird stuff going on. And then you, of course, had another long list of top titles.
Right. So Nightmare on Elm Street is a very popular example of something subjective and unreal entering reality. The fact that, you know, things that happen to you in your dreams, courtesy of Freddy Krueger, begin to affect and kill you in the real world. Lots of different versions of Owl Creek Bridge, including Jacob's Ladder, do that, where things where you enter a constantly changing space. Dark City is a horror science fiction head trip. It's not quite a horror movie, but it's absolutely literally you see reality shifting under you. To mention John Carpenter again, In the Mouth of Madness is his most reality horror movie that has touches of it throughout his oeuvre. Likewise, Lucio Fulci very often has a sense of reality breakdown, sometimes just because his plots make no sense, but at its best, as in, for example, in The Beyond, that seems to be part of the text as well as just sort of an accident of his interest in narrative.
And where you're being dismissive of great Italian directors, I think we can also adduce Suspiria as an example of possibly reality horror, in that the main character has no idea what's going on in the giant witch academy, but it might just be a liminal space that the Witch Academy is sitting there on Witch Town and not messing with anybody if you don't go dancing there.
Yeah, where the worms are coming from. That one's ambiguous. Yeah, and by the way, I'm not dismissing Lucio Fulci by saying that the narrative disconnection is a flaw. I think it's part of the magic of Fulci. And Andrew Jaworski's Possession is sort of a story of marital trauma that begins to seem to be changing reality around it. And Kiyoshi Kurosawa often plays with the idea of there sort of being a reality breakdown in the background of the odd things that are happening and sort of causing odd things to happen. And the apotheosis of that in his filmography is Pulse, where you have this sort of apocalyptic sense of reality breakdown that starts with ghosts coming out of the machine and escalates from there.
Yeah.
So I think these are both rich areas for horror scenarios. You don't necessarily have to distinguish for yourself whether something is liminal horror or reality horror, but it does make a difference in the problem solving that the characters will attempt to do, is attempt to survive whatever the horror is, because the idea of a liminal horror, the solution is just to get out of that space.
Yeah.
Get away from the satanic pigs.
Cross the boundary. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Leave the furniture store, whatever it is. Whereas in reality horror, you may have to deal with whatever it is that's begun to break down reality. And if it's even possible, to try and cause your reality to reassert itself.
And that is, again, we talked about Lovecraft as the foundational figure of liminal horror, that everything for him is a boundary. But the boundary then reveals that reality is not what we thought and is not conducive to our continued sanity or existence in some cases. And so Lovecraft is another example of someone who can do both, sometimes in the same story, but often a series of liminal horror stories present a reality horror by their cumulative impact. And I think you could argue that with Mackin as well, that a lot of his stories that begin as boundary crossers, like Great God Pan, eventually you begin to say, if all of these stories happen in the same universe, that implies pretty horrendous things about at least whales and certainly the whole rest of the universe.
Right. Well, now that we're contemplating the horror of whales, it's time for us, that sounds like a whole other subject. So it's time for us to cross the boundary to another hut and/or segment.
Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tynes, famous clairvoyants, divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Keep this podcast on mission alongside such beloved Patreon backers as
Dare Barefoot,
James Tatum,
Rich Spainauer,
Chuck Cooley,
and Dan O'Hanlon.
The chuttering of the IBM Selectric typewriter keys, the gurgle of mid-priced bourbon into a jelly jar, and the continuing attempt to frame the title of this hut into its introduction teach us once more how to write good. And today, in How to Write Good, we are once more engaging with a problem word. And today's problem word is seems. And at the first, you might say, what's wrong with seams? I say seams all the time. But the argument, if I may begin, is that there's no place to say that it seems such and such, because you've got to get to what it actually is, right? But seems is just a weasel word. It's, you seem angry. Well, is she angry? Let's have some dialogue, right?
Right. And I'm not going to argue that you should never use the word seems, but while writing prose, whenever you are revising your work, when you see the word scenes, you need to apply the most stringent possible eye on it. And I thought of this segment, Ken, because you recently on the Slack were upbraiding yourself for letting a seam slip through. And we all do it. So the question is it just sort of a flat weasel word that doesn't mean anything, a bit of sort of mush in your sentence, or are you using it for what it is meant for? And I do often see it in manuscripts being used as the mushy word. So it's like, you know, she seems to go to the laundromat every day, especially when said in an authoritative voice, does immediately raise the question, what do you mean seems? Raises a point of view of questions like, are you actually omniscient or are you, have you not been paying attention?
Right.
So you really want to flag anything where you do not mean to introduce the question of they look one way, but in fact are the other way. And especially in dialogue, of course, people do use the word seems all the time. So when someone says, well, she seems nice, that does actually, first of all, you're recording something that somebody said, so it's fine. But also, that includes what the reality is as well as the appearance. So I would argue that it's okay to use seems, although it's not the most exciting, vibrant verb. It is a verb and it is active. If you are indicating a difference between appearance and reality, and you then make clear the difference between appearance and reality.
And certainly if you're writing like an investigative scenario and you say, she seems to go to the laundromat every day, and then you don't ever pay it off, you may think, oh, well, I'm just giving the GM wiggle room. You're probably thinking, well, that's another word for my word count. But you have to pay it off. It has to either be, she goes to the laundromat every day. This is how you can ambush her and ask her questions about the centipede people in her house. Or it's, she seems to go to the laundromat every day, but you notice with stealth that she actually goes to the alley behind the laundromat and beats up hobos or whatever it is that she actually does instead of doing the laundromat. And that is why seems should be there, is to get you to the, but she's actually whatever.
Yes, exactly. And so make clear the difference between reality and appearance. And so there are stronger ways, especially so the question is, who is inferring the thing that seems, right? If you are talking about, you know, the player characters, for example, you may want to present that false reality as something that is intentional on the part of the person who is creating the false impression. So he takes pains to seem accommodating. You can put the butt in there, but turns out that he's got a knife under the counter and is trying to lure you in, completes the thought. Often takes pains to seem accommodating, however, does tell the whole story, because you can just take it as read that he is not accommodating at all and he's, you know, running some sort of trick on you. If it is an incorrect inference being made by a character, you could say, well, he strikes you as assertive, which again, since you're not saying he's assertive, that tells you something. But also there's the question of, well, who's the person perceiving this? If it's the player character, you don't actually know what the characters are perceiving. If there's somebody who is inactively creating a false impression, you know, he creates the impression of efficiency, but if you look in his desk drawer, there are all of these papers that he should have filed that he's thrown away. So that gives you room for the player characters to go, oh, well, initially he seemed efficient. He struck us as efficient, but that impression was incorrect, is something that you can then, again, resolve. But I guess what we're saying here is always use seems very intentionally to indicate a difference between appearance and reality.
Yeah, the thing that you want to avoid, I guess, to move it the other direction or flip it around, is what you want to avoid is to use seems as a synonym for is.
Yes.
Because it isn't. And you want to avoid using it to make your writing seem complex or deep when it is not. You don't want to say, you know, well, you know, this is a big old world and people are often not what they seem. I'm just going to allude to that throughout my writing. You know, he seems harmless. He seems efficient. She seems mad, but who can say really? I mean, Plato, maybe, but we're not Plato. We don't know. And that is just mush. That's just thought mush. And it's certainly thought mush in anything that is meant to help someone convey action or event or drama or anything that is supposed to be somewhat real and alive at the table. And I would argue also, if you're writing it in fiction and it's just, you're just putting it in because yes, in the real world, we do not know if she is angry. She only seems angry, but come on, people. That's not the point of the drama or the activity.
Right. And also, you should, in addition to not using it instead of is, you should find another active verb that isn't is, that isn't seems. Right. It often also appears as a hedge, right? That you're introducing a doubt where doubt need not exist. If you are writing about, you know, reality in an, you know, in an academic paper about, you know, where vampire beliefs were prevalent, it's, I think, perfectly acceptable to say it seems that this belief system died out around the 1200s because the hedge is correct, because you do not have all of the available evidence. You can never have all of that. But based on the evidence that you have, you are reaching a tentative conclusion. So in another form of writing, in nonfiction writing, where you do not have all the facts and you need to hedge, seems is in fact completely acceptable. But if you are constantly using seems, the question is, why are you introducing all of these mushy, uncertain facts? Why are you not just sticking to the facts or describing in a more specific, complex way why you are unable to fully land on saying that this is the case rather than this appears to be the case based on all of the evidence that I have?
That's jujitsu, is where you pile up a bunch of evidence for one proposition, and then you say, it seems that I'm right. And then that's, you know, I didn't say that it proves it, but, you know, here's the pile of evidence. I guess you have to think for yourself. And I don't deny that evidence could come along to controvert me. I've only studied the topic for 15 years. What do I know?
Yes.
But it is a little bit of an auctorial jujitsu there, which, again, I love an auctorial jujitsu, but overused, you begin to say, come on, own your dumb vampire theory, man.
Yes, it's a relative of one is tempted to conclude.
Right.
when you really want to say something and you're not, you want something to be true, but you can't quite prove the case yet, but you want to indicate that should be true. And so
often this is second reviewer's fault.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you've been called out on your lack of evidence. And so you've introduced a hedge. So, but when you were writing fictional nonfiction about a imaginary reality, if you're writing source book material, why are you hedging, right?
Right.
You know, it seems that this died out around 1200. Well, if you're writing in voice as an academic about your imaginary, you know, vampire dark ages, okay, sure. Maybe you're writing a bad writer, but that's a trick that we play to give ourselves a latitude. And if you're writing objective text that the GM is supposed to take as true about the world, you certainly never say, it seems that all the vampires died out in 1200. You say, the vampires died out in 1200. And you can always say, well, any statement here, the GM can then create an exception to, but the overuse of exceptions in order to create wiggle room, I think, is responsible far beyond the word seems for a lot of really bad, mushy role-playing prose. And so the wider point there is to, rather than hedge everything using seems or any other prose device, state the deal. And if there needs to be an exception, or if people need to be wrong about that, you can say, well, people firmly believe that vampires died out in 1200. You know what that sentence means. It means they didn't. But that's not a hedge. That's a switching from the objective view to the objective view of somebody else's subjective view.
And again, that's the seams that leads to the but. It's like, to anthropologists, it seems that vampires died out in 1200. But to you, the occultist, you know that they merely changed their feeding habits and went underground or whatever. And that but, or if you're doing like an old school Shadowrun book where you've got a book that's in voice, and then you have the more knowledgeable character contradict it, that's another way to sort of get around the mire of seams by using it, again, to set up the real truth, the contradiction, the thing that makes the story fun and meaty, that makes it a I know something you don't know power fantasy, which is the best kind of power fantasy, frankly.
Right. Well, if there's a mire anywhere around here, we want to get out of here before we get stuck in the mire.
So it seems that we are stuck in the mire, but
we will definitely be stuck in a mire if we stick around. So let's get out to another hut and or segment.
The British are coming.
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. The whirring of chronotons and the clacking of time gears tell us that we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine. This, of course, is the conveyance that Ken's superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And this time around, we're going to break the mold a little. You may have heard possibly the unusual sounds of Ken's room tone because Ken is recording this on the Wednesday before Gen Con. I'm at home in my usual office, but Ken is on the road. And so to spare him the research that would normally be required in a Ken's Time Machine episode, I thought we would sort of lightly touch on a bunch of different time adventures. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to mention a bunch of names, and Ken, you're going to tell us whether that person, when you met them, realized that you were a time traveler.
Right.
Now, some might think that I have just withheld the names and am giving them to you to improvise around and that you do not know the names of these, but that would imply that these are not real things that really happened in real time travel. And everybody knows that everything that Ken describes in this segment is stuff that really happened. So,
or really was about to going to happen sometimes.
Yes, exactly. So you listening at home, this is not a quiz for Ken. He knows the answers. I don't know the answers, but you can treat it as a quiz and you can guess ahead of time whether Ken is going to say that this person realized that he was a time traveler or not. Another proviso, sometimes a longtime listeners to Ken's Time Machine know that Ken will sometimes just sort of break form a little in a way that Time Incorporated disapproves of, but does not disallow. And he'll just tell people that he's a time traveler and show them the dossier in order to get them to do the thing that he needs them to do. So implicit in this question is that none of these people are people to whom Ken, at least in his initial meeting with them, revealed himself overtly to be a time traveler. So
right.
The question is, did they figure it out? There's lots of dumb historical figures that you've met who didn't figure it out, but we're going to focus on people who are smart, who might well have gotten it. So the first one, since we're thinking also a little bit about Nations and Cannons and their upcoming Kickstarter, I thought I'd throw in a figure of the Revolutionary period and find out whether Ben Franklin, Ken, knew that you were a time traveler. Did he figure that out?
Ben Franklin guessed that I was a time traveler. Actually, at first, he thought I was from the scientific island of Laputa from Gulliver's Travels. And I tried to sort of let that roll as long as I possibly could. That Gulliver's Travels is a documentary, Ben Franklin. You know, all kinds of stuff is crazy and real. You're a Freemason, for gosh sakes. But eventually he sort of sussed it out. And wildly, it was language use was one of the things. And also, no one from the island of scientists can come up with as many new drinks as I could. So between the two of them, Ben sussed it out. But it took a little bit of a time. And maybe he was playing with me. I can't rule that out because he's a canny old fellow. My only hope, really, to outwit Ben is that he was often very distracted with other stuff or French ladies. So That helped out.
Right. So he sort of forgot about it and didn't write it in his almanac.
Well, no. I mean, you can't put stuff like that in an almanac. People will say, this does not help me grow crops whatsoever, nor is it good advice for my daily life. And he said, well, you got me there, folks. Don't drink with a time traveler while good advice is not actually, you know, actionable for most people.
Next up, did Marie Laveau identify you as a time traveler?
Marie Laveau did not. Marie Laveau had met so many weird white guys by the time she and I hung out that at this point, she just does not care about your backstory. I did try very, very hard to prevent the Loa from finding anything out about my backstory. I don't need that headache. But Marie was just, look, you're a dude. You've got some kind of weird bee in your bonnet about antebellum New Orleans politics or the yellow fever or something. Sure, knock yourself out. Tell Marie where it hurts, buddy. And then, you know, pay up. So Marie, very professional, did not care.
Not all people who are savvy are intellectual. Some of them are street smart, or in this case, butte smart. Did Newman Old Man Clanton ID you as a time traveler, Ken?
Well, the trouble is that Newman Old Man Clanton, father of Ike Clanton and of other Clantons that were killed at the OK Corral, identified me as a Republican and therefore did not have anything he wanted to say to me. So the sons, the other Clantons, noticed that I was something of a greenhorn, that my fast draw was not what it ought to be. So I think they sort of just put me out of mind. I think the McClowries were a little smarter about it, but they did not, you know, have any sort of notion even of time travel existing. And I, again, tried to stay out of Wyatt Earp's eye as much as I possibly could. But I feel like Newman definitely knew I wasn't from around these parts and that I had a sort of a Yankee air to me, and that was enough for him.
Tang Dynasty Empress Wu Zhaochen, did she figure out that you were a time traveler?
Almost immediately. I don't think I was the first time traveler at the court, in fairness. I feel like if I'd been the first, the cover might have lasted a little bit longer. But, you know, I personally feel like I did everything I could. I spent a good long time practicing Sogdian, everything. I had the outfit, the whole nine yards. But apparently I was like the fifth or 17th, depending on how you count it, time traveler to show up at her court. And she was like, oh, okay, you're one of those guys. And again, she was very cool about it. There was a protocol even. There was like a Mandarin whose job it was to sort of take notes and put you in the little appointment book, which was actually kind of geometrically very complex, it being a time travel appointment book. But yeah, she'd seen it before. This was old hat to her, really.
And did she try to wrest secrets about the future from you?
I guess the last couple of guys did not have any particularly useful secrets for her to wrest. So I said, oh yeah, you're going to reign a long old time. The Tang Dynasty is going to be looked back on forever as the greatest period of Chinese history. And she says, well, fair enough. What did you need me to do about this canal? And I said, don't build it. And she says, well, that's not happening. And I said, well, I tried. We shook hands, parted as friends. We didn't shake hands. That would be Les Majesty, and I would have been executed in a wire cage. But I think she nodded at me.
Mary Shelley, did she figure out that you're a time traveler?
Mary Shelley, again, this was one of those things where she just thought that I was an American. And like her old buddy Aaron Burr, she loved Americans. Politically, she loved Americans because they hated the monarchy, and so did she. And so she very much enjoys talking to Americans. She thought it was great. And then eventually, I think what tipped it for her was that my accent was not anywhere near the same as Aaron Burr's or the other Americans that she met. And again, I don't know that she never like called me out on it, but at some point in our friendship, she took on like a different kind of a look, and it wasn't the, you know, oh, you know, you're like my goof husband. It was more, I mean, yes, fair enough. I am a writer, but she may have been like, there's something off about this guy, but I don't know that she pegged it. But again, she was very, very distracted. She was having the kid and losing the kid and going through all that other stuff. Byron, it was a situation. You know, frankly, it was just very nice of her. And I think really it was just a relaxing moment. She could go out, she could drink iced tea. We could all have a good chat about Thomas Jefferson and stuff. So that was really nice.
Okay, next up, Grontar the Eviscerator.
Grontar the Eviscerator, the way that he tells if you're a time traveler, and this is kind of funny, is he will eviscerate you. And then he'll sort of sift through all your bits to see if you've got like a artificial knee or whatever kind of a thing. And I got to say that the way that he was beckoning to the supervising sub-eviscerator made me think he'd thought very strongly that I might be a time traveler. That's where you bite down on the recall button and just, you know, go back and you say, what if we went 100 years before and Grontar's granddad fell into a crevasse? Wouldn't that be fun? And time travel, they're still looking through that recommendation.
Right. And so, well, jokes, I believe you have erased him from the time stream. So,
well, I mean, he's not there now, but
yeah.
The trouble with an eviscerator is they will keep popping back up. You got to, it's like mice. You just got to keep going at it.
Right. So that is a tip for the listener. We always like to include tips for the listener.
Right.
If you encounter someone who you think is a time traveler, be nice to them, because if you're a total jerk, and I guess really this advice only extends to, you know, if you're an eviscerator level total jerk.
But, right. Yeah.
You know, don't do anything that would make the time traveler.
If I were removing total jerks from the time stream, Robin, first of all, I'd get nothing else done. And second of all, well, the GNP would suffer, I feel.
Right. Yeah. So certainly I guess I withdraw this tip, because no one listening to our podcast is a jerk who needs to be removed from the time stream. So
they're not eviscerators.
They're not.
I mean, the two eviscerators we did have listening have been removed from the time stream. My apologies. Sorry about that.
Even as we speak.
They weren't Patreon
And
backers.
Finally, did Napoleon Bonaparte figure out that you were a time traveler?
Napoleon did not. And that was weird, because he's got this reputation of being a very canny and savvy judge of people. And we bonded over the hated British thing. That was a big connection for us. And having been smart guys in provincial colleges, that was another, you know, real connection. And Napoleon, another guy who loved Americans, much like Mary Shelley did. And so I think that Napoleon just, there was some corner he didn't turn. He just, again, I'm not sure that he eventually stayed buying the original theory that I was an American from the Department of War and I was just over asking questions and drinking a couple of comradely drinks and making a couple of suggestions about deployments in Marengo. I think that eventually he did think there was something more going on, but I think he may have just then assumed that President Jefferson and then President Madison were up to more stuff than they actually were. He was like, oh, you're on a secret agenda. That's cool. I'll keep you close and figure it out. But he never took the next step and said, oh, time traveler. That was not his métier. But again, part of it is that he had a lot of other stuff on his mind. And part of it, like Mary Shelley, is I think that he just liked the conversations too much. And he felt that you bring up the awkward, are you a time traveler, that might mean I would have to say, I'm sorry, your granddads are going to fall into a crevasse. And that's, no one wants that. Certainly they don't want it for Napoleon. Although there is a fairly hefty make Napoleon's granddad fall into a crevasse file that someone started. I'm against it personally.
It does have a lot of knock-on effects. And if this was a regular episode, I might encourage you to describe those knock-on effects. But this is the episode that you record before you go off to have fun at Gen Con. And you're going to have, as was true last year, you'll have to have twice as much fun so you can have my fun as well.
Yes.
And listeners, this has already happened. It is in your past. If you fall into Gen Con, you're perhaps in a liminal space, or reality horror has happened to you. So I believe all of our segments, Ken, are falling into one another. Things seem bad.
They have seemed to do so, certainly.
You may have a mission to deal with, listeners, so let's get out of here before everything falls apart. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Simple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Keep this podcast from vanishing in the back rooms by joining such backers as
Eric Parks,
Oleg,
Chris McLaren,
Darren Dumay,
and Eric R.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindelaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.